You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
In India, I met farmers whose crops have been literally washed away by historic flooding. In America, I have witnessed unprecedented droughts in California. In Greenland and in the Arctic, I was astonished to see that ancient glaciers are rapidly disappearing, well ahead of scientific predictions. All that I have seen and learned on my journey has absolutely terrified me.
So the question now is whether we will have the courage to act before it's too late. And how we answer will have a profound impact on the world that we leave behind, not just to you, but to your children and to your grandchildren. As a president, as a father, and as an American, I'm here to say we need to act.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Hey, Angie. So just an update for the listeners. Last week, we didn't do a news segment. You were on death's door with the flu, or you felt like you're on death's
door.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe it was the flu. I don't know if I've ever had the flu that bad before. I thought I've had Giardia in Africa and in Ecuador one time.
Sounds scary.
And this was almost as bad. So it was, it was something.
That's why you get the flu shot. I mean, and I know the flu shot doesn't cover everything, but I did get, so I got the flu shot in Florida in last November. And then when we got to New Zealand, we got another flu shot because the different strains around the world. So like the ones I get here from like Asia, the ones in Europe, the ones in North America. So you get like a whole cocktail.
Well, I should, but the running joke in my family, pretty much between my husband and I is I just don't get sick. I have the immune system of a goat. I'm tough as nails. And so of course, John had to rub it in a little bit. He's like, I thought you never get sick. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't, but when I do, it's like the world is over.
Yeah. But you're back. Mm-hmm. And so Angie and I were talking. So what we're going to do with the format of the podcast for now is we're going to guarantee you two episodes a week. We have just been getting a little bit overwhelmed trying to do three a week with these interviews. We have a lot of great interviews scheduled coming up, and between those and editing and getting that pushed out and then doing the news, it just got a little much. So what Angie and I are going to do is we're going to guarantee you two episodes a week, no matter what. We'll have a new species, and then we will have either news or an interview later in the week. And that way, you know, you can listen to some other great podcasts out there and we don't take up all your time, but we do appreciate it.
And someday if we can figure out how to get all of our ducks in a row, we would love to podcast even more for everyone, but that'll take a little bit more organization for Chris and I. We're still new to this game and trying to figure it all out. So keep up with the support and the love, and don't listen to any other podcasts. I don't know what Chris is talking about.
Broaden your horizons. Yeah, they can listen to Corbin's or some other ones because we're, you know, we got some stuff coming.
Animals
to
the Max is the bomb. If you have not checked that out, please check that out. Yeah. He's brilliant and very funny and very knowledgeable.
Yeah. Energetic. You know, it's what you need in the morning. It does. It really gets me going when I listen to him talk. And then just also, you know, we're coming in on the year anniversary and of our podcast. And so we're going to really, you know, Angie and I are hammering some things out to make sure this is a very long running show. And then, Angie, you know, if once we're making millions, then we can hire people to do all that extra work. And then
that's right. And I said, I could do 5 podcasts for a week because all I do is show up and talk, which we all, if you're listening and listen long enough, everybody knows that I could probably talk to a wall. So poor Chris that he does all of the editing, all the website. This guy is amazing. So make sure and give him give him some love and some shout outs because
it's great. It's fun. It's fun.
Yeah, you're really good at it, but it is very time consuming here, and because you do
it is it
like,
is it
we,
is
or we like to put out a good product, which means AKA you have the laborious part.
So that, you know, moving on to this week in conservation, I think you had some good stories, right? I've got a mixed bag. I've got some interesting stories, sad stories, good news stories. So let's start off with something good that you found.
Yeah. Well, some great news. Everybody knows, or if you don't by now, you should know that I'm a big fan of hoof and horns and antlers. And so great news out of Belfast, Northern Ireland. This, just recently, Miss Betty Bantu, she's a Blessbach calf. She was born at the zoo there. And for those of you that most people, there's a lot of hoof stock in Africa. Even me, I like to think that I'm good at all knowing all my gazelles and antelopes. It is even hard. I have to have the guidebook out, whatever region I'm in, making sure that I know what I'm spotting. And so for those of you that aren't familiar, we will cover it sometime, but a Blessbach is this gorgeous medium-sized antelope, dark brown in color with white underbelly and white almost leggings, like stockings. And then it has a beautiful thick white blaze down its face. For anybody who knows horses, that's really a sought-after marking because it's just so pretty with the big wide white stripe down the face. And of course, being an antelope, it has two brilliant horns that stick up, and the Blessbach were almost hunted to extinction years ago. And so they've made a nice rebound, probably due to conservation efforts. Yeah, yeah. And this calf, Betty Bantu, is the 11th calf born at this zoo throughout the years.
That's good.
So kudos to you, Belfast Zoo. I don't know if we have any friends in Northern Ireland, but hopefully we do now. But I like what you do, and I like what I see because this calf is just super cute.
Yeah, no, we got some listeners in the UK and around there, so hopefully they do. And yeah, it's weird because it's good news because, again, an endangered species, the interview we've got coming, I remember listening to the person that Angie interviewed. Is a big.
Amazing. Awesome.
Yes, it was a great interview.
And my new BFF.
And I really, one thing that stuck out with me on that interview, and I can't wait to post it, and hopefully next week we get to post it, is he was talking about, we don't want these animals in captivity, but we might have to bring them, or we're bringing them into captivity or under human care, because they're going extinct in the wild, right? So when you hear these endangered species have successful breeding, as a reproductive physiologist, it's really good news for us.
Sure. Absolutely. And the Blessbach, I don't know how... if they were ever endangered, or they were never critically endangered, I don't think, but their numbers were way down probably due to hunting, and poaching, and of course, meat eating. So yeah, so it's great that their numbers are least concerned now. They're doing great, and they're just a beautiful sight to behold, both in Africa or in Northern Ireland. Check them out.
Right. So this one, Angie, it's pretty funny. This is something new too, because we usually always cover exotics. This is going to endangered breeds of horses. So
we're sticking with the hoof theme.
Yes,
today.
The hoof theme. Awesome. And this one is really cool because I've got my horse book coming out in a couple months, and this was one of the breeds I covered. And I didn't, after doing all my research to write that book and researching the breeds, I know now about it. But the title of this article is the Great British Shire Horse About to Go Extinct?
Cool. So, the Shire Horse.
Yeah. So one of the, it's the largest horse in the world. Like, mm-hmm. Let me just put that out first. And let me get an excerpt from my book. And I looked this up. Shire horses are known as the largest horses in the world. So the largest horse ever measured was a horse named Mammoth.
I love it.
He was born in the year, 1846 in the UK or in England. He stood 21.2 hands, which is a measurement in the horse world, or 219 centimeters, or for us in the States, it's over 7 feet at the shoulder.
Wow. Jeez.
7 feet tall at the shoulder.
Uh-huh. I like horses, but not the guy. That's big.
Yeah. 7 feet. He weighed an estimated 3,400 pounds or 1,500 kilograms. So he was
like
massive.
Three horses, basically.
He's huge, huge. So it was interesting because, you know, doing all these breeds and breeds of the world and, you know, how horses were evolved in Asia and Europe and Africa. And then the ones that they brought to the New World, you know, in North America and South America. Shires were just one of the ones I looked into. So what happened is these were working draft horses. Right. That's kind of where their history was in the agrarian times, like after medieval times when it really everybody became farming communities and kind of settled down rather than small plots like these larger farms. Heavy horses became really, really important. So they bred tons of them and they pulled carts. Like that's how you got around instead of cars. Everybody had a horse or a donkey or a pony. You know, to get from point A to point B or pull carts and things like that. So in 1900, it was estimated there was 1 million Shire horses just in the UK
alone.
That's
a lot of horse.
Like work. Yeah. Yeah. But they were part of, you know, that was your car, right? Or that was your cart or that's how you worked
the farm.
Oh, it was
so cute today. Xander says to me, he's like, yeah, we could live on a farm and not have a car and just ride horses everywhere. And I just was like, son of mine, I love you so.
Yes, I know. It would be cool to go back to that to an extent.
Yeah, until I need to go to Trader Joe's to get some specialty ice cream or something. And I'd be like nuts.
Because literally you would have to go get your animals, hook them up to the cart, which takes forever. Drive down to the store, which will take forever. Park your cart.
Well, I actually envision it because I love riding so much. I envision myself just galloping through the streets, like get there. I don't need a cart. I would just need a saddlebag. But then I'm thinking, oh, I need a saddlebag with ice for like, so my ice cream doesn't melt. So yeah, it would get tricky.
it's the convenience of technology is we take it for granted. Anyways. So you had 1 million horses in 1900. And then in the late 20th century, the breed, because of automobiles and everything, was down to 1,500 horses, Shire horses left.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably do cost a lot to feed. I will say that.
Yeah. And they're such a novelty breed. But it's not just them. In the United Kingdom, they're worried about Clydesdales and Suffolk horses that they just had 240 Shire horses born last year, less than 200 Clydesdales, and only 25 Suffolk horses. So this rare breed survival trust is trying to shed some light on them. Hopefully some hobbyists will get involved and start breeding them. I mean, I love horses. I argue with people. I think they've done more for us than any other species. You know, in this, they talk about war horses, you know, they've died with us on all those battlefields.
The stories are incredible.
Yeah, they've been really crazy. So it's just interesting that we talk a lot about endangered species, which in my opinion is way more important, just my own personal opinion. But sometimes it's nice to think about these endangered breeds that, it took a couple hundred years to get to a Shire horse to what they are today. Mm-hmm. And it would be sad to lose such an amazing specimen.
Yeah. What, like you said, an amazing specimen and just kind of this iconic workhorse too, right? And drastically unique from a lot of the other breeds. But it'll be interesting. I know that there's people that are into the heirloom species or some of these older ones and not letting – even though they're domestic, they're not in danger, trying to keep the numbers up and making sure they stay diverse genetically, right?
That's important. Yeah, so it's just interesting to think about, you know. And I know there's been some extinct species. One
– Oh, yeah.
One that comes to mind is the Canadian pacer. So I used to joke around with Danielle, the Canadian horses. I would go, hey, I put some in my book just for you. But the Canadian pacer was one that could like pace on icy roads and not really like fall down. They had really sturdy feet, but they're gone. They're gone. They got bred out.
Okay. So
now they just have a Canadian horse, which I guess says eh all the time or
ne, or ne.
I don't know.
Ne.
Eh, ne. Ne.
Or a boat.
So, anyways,
they say hoof. Hoof all the time.
Hoof. There you go, Danielle, just for you. So I thought that was interesting and just a different news story this week.
Awesome. Well, for my next story that I've chosen, it's been all over the news here, especially in southeastern United States, probably nationally, but it's near and dear to my great state of Florida that's currently housing me. And I talk about the story as I'm preparing for a big beach trip for my boys tomorrow. We're heading over to the Atlantic coast to enjoy the beaches over there for the day. It's one of our closer beaches. But also I wanted to avoid the West Coast due to what is called the red tide that has been. And just briefly, well, this probably isn't going to be brief, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's a very interesting story and interesting conservation story. And then it also brings up a lot of other issues. So this red tide, it's basically a type of algae. Mm-hmm. So it's alive. It's an organism. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon, especially around the southwest coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. And it comes annually here and there. In fact, these algaes are always in the water. Mm-hmm. However, when it's considered a bloom, so right now we have a red tide bloom off the southwestern shores of Florida, means that it's obviously blooming. So just think of them like a lot more, like they're multiplying. For instance, this red tide comes from a type of algae called K. brevis. And typically our concentrations are about 100 cells per liter in this area. But recently, this red tide has been blooming or growing since October 2017, so October of last year. But now the cells are about 10 million cells per liter.
Wow.
So a big...
Don't drink the water. Yeah.
A big increase. And
yes,
in some spots, it's been counts of up to 140 million cells per liter. And you say, well, why? Who cares? Okay, so the ocean looks a little red, yada blada.
Right.
But what these, red tide, these algaes produce is called a brevitoxin. And so toxin obviously means no bueno. And they are in the air so thick right now that some people out in Naples, Florida thought that the armed forces had poured nerve gas into the Gulf. And as far as irritating and choking their eyes and their lungs. So it creates this toxin that, of course, is obnoxious to people that are trying to enjoy the beach. But obviously us people can leave the beach or not go to the beach that day, right?
Right.
So these animals are exposed to this crazy amount of algae, which basically when they ingest it, it can cause gastrointestinal problems and neurological problems. And incidentally, people just say the animals almost look like they're comatose, and then they obviously typically die. Mm-hmm. And so the animal, the sea creatures being affected out of the red tide in southwest Florida are everything from fish, so mullet fish, catfish, puffer fish, snook, trout, grunt, and even Goliath groupers, which we need to cover that in the podcast. Those guys are awesome and amazing. But also crabs, eels, but also 80 manatees have washed ashore during this crisis. And turtles, including the critically endangered Kemp Ridley sea turtle. And then even more recently, just last week, this past week, a juvenile whale shark.
Yeah. Watch that, Chris.
I mean, we've covered the whale shark. We've covered the manatees, and we're soon we're going to be covering the sea turtle.
Right.
So these guys are being hit super hard due to this toxin, and or this algae that causes this toxin. And it's just really, once again, this is kind of a seasonal thing, and it does happen in Florida. It just seems to be happening greater and stronger. And the other part that's really kind of a storm of extra problems, if you will, is that we also have in Florida, we're known for, a lot of lakes are known for blue-green algae.
Right.
And that's another algae that, once again, is naturally occurring. However, with the introductions of excess nutrient overloads, pollutions from fertilizers, sewage, agriculture, stormwater, human activities, these blue-green or cyanobacteria blooms happen more frequently, last longer. So interestingly enough, that's happening big time in some of our lakes, but one of the really big lakes in Florida is Lake Okeechobee. Because of overflow issues in that lake area, they've had to release some of the lake further for it to move downstream towards the oceans. And so when this blue-green algae moves from lakes towards the oceans, and the oceans, a lot of times it dies, and that's fine, but then it acts as food or more nutrients, and also runoff, agricultural runoff, sewage, things like that, human activities, and into our oceans, also act as fuel to feed this red tide. It's basically, we're kind of getting a little bit of a double whammy here in Florida. And then on top of that, so it's like, who do we, you know, what do we blame? Researchers are also blaming the most recent hurricane here that came through this past year, Hurricane Irma, that came into Naples really hot and heavy, did a lot of damage there. Those churn things up, and that causes more runoff. And that's obviously, that's not really man-made, although we could argue climate change. So anyways, it's just kind of this perfect storm. And some people are blaming humans, but a lot of people are like, well, let's just try to figure out the problem, because all these innocent, I mean, hundreds and thousands of fish, let alone some manatees and other mammals and or whale sharks, things like that, are dying off, let alone all. I come from a beach community in Michigan, and these poor beach communities that these business owners that are just, you know, and I hate to say it, like, I probably wouldn't travel that far south anyways, down to Sarasota area or whatnot, to go to the beach, because it's further from my house, but I can see why the people that would normally choose to go to that beach might not want to go to this gross beach right now.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think we just talked in, maybe it was the last pod we did, how I loved to go to Cocoa Beach when I was there. And if there's a red tide, I wouldn't go to Cocoa Beach. And, you know, when we go to these restaurants and we eat out all the time and all these things. And so and rent, you know, either Airbnb or a condo or something like that. If you have this red tide and it's the peak of travel season right now for you in the States. So yeah, I mean, it affects, there's a human cost too.
It is. And it's tough. It's, like, there's debate on both sides. Like, is it humans' fault? And is it just a natural, obviously it's naturally in the water. There are going to be blooms. There was another big one back in 2005 or six that followed another hurricane. So there's just, at this point, there's not enough data to point the finger. Is it 100% like human runoff problems? These nutrients that are feeding all these blooms. Yeah. I think the answer in the lakes in the center of the state, yes, definitely. But they're trying to control that, and that's like a separate political, huge political issue in Florida that's not, obviously not resolved, or probably won't be soon with our current government. But the ocean one's a little bit different. So a lot of researchers, experts say that it's both to blame. It's probably human induced, somewhat natural.
Right. A mix of both.
In the meantime, what can be done? That's always my thing. And there's all these wonderful volunteers that are going to clean up beaches. And I would say go out and support your locals, even if maybe you just get to go food and eat it from the beach restaurant and eat it at home, or spread the word, get people about any kind of runoff, things like that. Keep your beaches clean when you do go there, or any water, if you live near any water, try to reduce your own pollution.
You know, and then, yeah. Yeah, it's, interesting to see, you know, dealing with nature and these things come up and how we react.
Right. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the reaction is like to want to point the finger and this and that, which that's good. It's good to get through the problem.
You got to know why, but you
gotta fix it. Well, and that's where these scientists are smart for trying to like fix it, not wait for government, because government's so locked up in all of their, you know what, that they a lot of times don't get anything done. So in the meantime, you got to try to figure it out. And hopefully I don't know how, I mean, these things can bloom for a while. It's been coming since October of last year. So I don't know.
Yeah.
It's been a while. This, it's obviously reached the news and it's reached more, you know, epic levels than it has in the past 10 or 15 years.
But yeah.
Yeah. So,
well, let's keep it in the ocean.
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
But not great news. It's okay. So a few weeks ago, I talked about the southern resident orcas, and these are the pod that lives off Washington State in Canada.
Sure. They're pretty famous.
And it's the Salish Seas. These are the ones that you see in Seattle. The sound there. When I lived up there, I never did see them, but I know in the news I would see, and they're like, oh, you know, a pod of orcas are swimming around in the sound around there. So I talked about how they were endangered. You know, this subspecies or this group was endangered. Well, for the last 2 weeks in the news is this orca identified as J35. She has been carrying her dead calf with her for the last 16 days. 16 days.
That's incredible.
I see this every day in my news feed. It's the next day. And I can't imagine that calf. I don't know what's left of it. It's pretty horrific to think about, but apparently this female orca, she gave birth. The calf died within like the hour.
Okay. And obviously we don't know why. Right? Since. We don't know why.
So yeah. And looking at this, you know, what I was talking about was, you know, the reason these orcas are endangered, or this pod's endangered, is they're in a very busy waterway. So between Vancouver and Seattle. And then they were talking about the Canadian government wanting to get the oil pipeline from Alberta or whatever over to Vancouver area. And that's just going to drastically increase boat traffic. And people are really worried about this pod. So in the last 3 years, none of the calves born, I think it was three of them, did not survive.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And in the past 20 years, only 40 orcas have been born into this group, but 72 have died.
Oh, wow.
So they're in a way negative trajectory.
Of course.
So a lot of the other thing too is salmon. So that's their number one prey item. And there's just not enough salmon is what they think up there. That, you know, some salmon species are endangered. And so.
Sure, of course. So they don't,
Yeah. So that it brings up an interesting question. So we're going to keep my eye on this, obviously. Looking at this female, and Angie's my behavior expert. And I just wanted to, you know, I know certain species grieve, and specifically, I know elephants do. They.
Sure.
Will go pick. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely elephants and cetaceans, which obviously those are whales and dolphins. So the killer whale, or the orca, falls under that. Magpies, a type of bird. I recently was reading an article about crows. Did we just discuss it on the pod? If it was
no, you were, I think crows, you were going to. Yeah.
Yeah, they do funerals. I mean, I think it's definitely an emotion that animals experience, and of course, there's documentation of this in in the wild and some living under human care. And then I would go to say that there's been anecdotal evidence. I'm not sure, I'd have to go back to the literature, but there's been anecdotal evidence of wolves, dogs, geese, other animals besides what you would what we classify as the highly intelligent animals, such as cetaceans and elephants and chimpanzees.
Right, right.
And now I would say, chimpanzees are on that list also of
they are.
So,
it just, for me, it brought up a lot because I remember a teaching moment I had with my students, and you know, I was up in class and I said, do animals feel? And all the students laughed. And these were, you know, animal science students, pre-vets, some are, you know, livestock, whatever. And they, it was like kind of taken as a joke that, that animals have feelings, you know, and I asked that. I said,
really? They like laughed like they didn't think, they thought no.
No. Yeah. Yeah. And
really,
I was like, okay. And I was a little bit surprised, but you know, taking the group, I was,
you don't want to judge. Sure. Yeah.
No, taking the group. And so I said, okay, let me ask you this. When you yell, you come home, your dog chewed up your couch and you yell at them, what do? They cower. They're scared.
Yeah.
Right? Or they, or
unless it was my rescue husky dog, I think he just would give me the middle finger.
Well, that's a cat too. That's cats.
Yeah,
are
well,
good.
He, Sinatra, he was like basically, I used to call him my dog cat.
Yeah. But, you know, or you, when you come home, like, let's not say the dog chewed the couch, but let's just say you come home, the dog is like all over you. There's a greeting, they're wagging their tail, they're licking you, they're excited is a way to put it. They seem happy. You know, and not to anthropomorphize animal feelings, but I made the point that, yeah, you just can't look at animals as instinctual robots. That is not what they are. Now, we can't go and say, are they going to build a rocket and go to the moon? You know, they're not that level of advanced.
I mean, Chris, when was the last time we did that? It's been a while.
Well, look who's taking over the country. So, yeah, we're right. Definitely de-evolving.
Yeah, definitely.
But so this just brought it up. It was interesting. So I did find a good study. I'm going to link this too. It's called Animal Emotions, Exploring Passionate Natures. It's just kind of a paper.
We should
talking
do a whole
about,
pot. I would love to do a whole pot on this.
Okay. Maybe we can. You know, joy, fear, love, despair, and grief. I think it talks about Jane Goodall observed Flint, an 8-year-old chimpanzee that when his mom died, he just basically withdrew from the groups, starved himself and died.
Yeah. You know, there's a great book out there called When Elephants Weep. It's a little dated. Yep. I think it's 95 or 96. Yep. I read it either in college or after college. Mm-hmm. I'm showing my age here. I read it years and years and years after college. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, I take that. Sorry, mom brain. I read it when I was like 5. So
yeah, right.
It's what inspired.
You were like, dude, that's when you finished your PhD, right? That was like way before I got mine.
Oh yeah. Gosh, I can't even do math on what would make me older or not older. It's been a long week. But anyways, yes, but that it's a great book.
Yeah.
And,
so
and there's
yeah,
been
let's
other
maybe do that.
And,
let's do
and
that.
I think that. Or just in general, it'd be fun to hear from the listeners about their thoughts on what, like, I know, for instance, my dog, Gypsy, I love her, Gypsy girl. She, we travel a lot and we take her a lot of places, especially just locally if we're going in Florida. And so because she knows what packing means, and of course, because I have two little, because I have two little kids, there's a lot of packing. So I just, unfortunately, those days of just throwing a few things in my backpack and hitting the road are gone.
Yeah.
Now I have a list of like, make sure and bring the baby monitor and a thermometer. And 1400 snacks for the road.
Yes. Yep.
But anyways,
it's a nightmare. Yeah.
So yeah, but what I do is most of the time she gets to come with us. And so I actually pack her bag first.
Okay.
So she knows her dog food, her bed, her bowls, her harness, a toy or two. She basically is like me in my 20s. She doesn't get much in her bag. So she's easy to pack.
Yeah.
Always pack her first and set off the side. And honestly, like she can relax on trips where we're traveling to Boston or Michigan. And unfortunately she can't come, that she is very
nervous,
upset.
Yeah.
Yes. She knows we are leaving and it's not one, it's one thing to be like, okay, she knows we're leaving, but another thing for her, she's visibly like upset about it and pouting and sad. And like she did something wrong. And so, it's definitely, it'd be a fun podcast, but this poor orca
animal
mama,
emotions,
it'll be interesting. I guess it's sad for her loss of her calf. I really hope people do keep documenting this and do keep bringing awareness about it. I don't think any species, including these orcas, this pod will ever be saved unless people actually start caring about them. And sometimes some ways to care about something is to actually be touched by it, you know, or have a a reaction from it. And I think if there are any orca naysayers out there, which obviously people that, you know, probably don't care about them in the wild.
They're not listening.
Yeah, I guess they're probably
they're not listening to this podcast.
They're not listening to our podcast for sure now. Oh my gosh.
But they're out there.
But what I'm saying is I hope that this circulation is hitting their news feeds like it is ours. I mean, ours are our news feeds are obviously more animal oriented, but the story's been pretty national. And so hopefully we can learn something from it, learn about these beautiful, amazing, intelligent, emotional creatures.
Yeah. Yeah. And the scientists just reading this too, they are worried about her, and they have a nickname for her. But J35 is how she's identified for the science community. They are worried about her mental health. Like, this is not a normal grief behavior past this point. Like, I guarantee you initially it was grief. I mean, I guess it is a grief behavior, but now it's like, it's just, she's probably so stressed and they're like, she's not eating. Yeah, obviously she can't regain all her strength after pregnancy.
Do they know if this was her first calf or she had other calves she's lost? Or
I didn't pick up on that, but I mean, there literally are 5,100 stories out there on this. So if you just Google, and I'll try to find out some more and link it. But yeah, I like that idea of talking about animal emotions. Like, that would be a good pod to maybe.
Well, and you and I have been talking. I actually was thinking about this today. Interestingly enough, we've talked about. I'd like to cover the dog in the new.
That's true. In the
future, maybe after we reboot, after our after we hit our year mark, and then I was thinking like, well, should we? What kind of specialist interview could we have, for a dog? Because I mean, we could do a vet, but vets. They're going to have a medical perspective, which is great, but it'd almost be more fun to interview like a dog psychologist or something. Like, am I crazy? Does my dog know that I'm packing and get upset about or not?
Well, and I mean, reading this story too, this scientific article, Animal Emotions, there's a lot of research that needs to be done. That's basically what it's saying. It's like, hey, we have this evidence, but we don't, you know, it can lead to conclusions. From our perspective, like, yeah, that to us, that looks like a feeling or some sort of, you know, advanced behavior, but we don't have the research in neurobiology or endocrinology connecting those behaviors to other things.
Correct.
So we need more studies, basically.
I know. I wish somebody would give me a job. That'd be like a dream job of mine for sure.
Yeah.
No, you're right. We definitely need more research to kind of support some of these claims or to figure them out in the different levels. But I would love to see the science backing it up. In the interim, it does pose it pulls at your heartstrings and it incites a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure, for sure. Now, I've got a really cool sci-fi story coming up, but you actually have an inspirational story next, right?
I do. Yeah. Speaking of, we were talking about orcas, and now we went from hoofs and horns, now to the ocean.
To the oceans,
To the oceans. I'm becoming like a huge ocean fan. Not that I wasn't before, but this podcast is really just, we've dove in deep in the ocean, and I'm really enjoying it.
Yes. Yeah, there's some cool stuff.
Yeah, but this one is interesting. So this goes to show, like, when you and I, like, Chris, Angie, are we doing the right thing? Like, we should probably go have, like, real jobs, which we should, and I'm getting one, so yay for me.
Yeah.
Even though it's part-time, but whatever. But
need money.
need to eat. Need food. So, but this one is about, it's never too late to get involved in conservation. So for any listener out there that's like, well, I love animals, but I have a desk job and I can't do conservation.
Right.
I'm going to probably not say the name right, but Elfin. Yes, I think it's Elfin Pugh would disagree. Mm-hmm. So he was in his early 50s and when he first became a guide on whale watching trips. And then from there, that led to his current position as a volunteer for Marine Mammal Survey team leader.
Okay.
And he's also part of a wildlife guide and a trustee for ORCA. And that's an acronym for Organization Protecting Whales and Dolphins in the UK and Europe. So he's studying cetaceans and being a tour guide for them, and also a board of trustees. And we'll link this. We'll put a story. It's a really cool story on our show notes. But basically, interestingly enough, Chris and I can probably relate to this. Elfin, if I'm sorry, if I'm not saying your name right, but his first job, he was actually a zookeeper and took care of animals when he was a lot younger. But then he became a police officer for 30 years until he retired.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I guess they get to retire earlier than we do here in the United States over there.
Yeah, it's like the military. Yeah, it's like, if you've done 20 years or 30 years, you get a nice pension.
But anyways, he always loved birds and mammals, and his interest in marine conservation didn't really take off until his like earlier mid-50s. And so he doesn't have a degree at all, and definitely doesn't have a degree in marine scientists. But he's done a lot of courses relating to cetaceans. Cetaceans, that's whales and dolphins, and seabird ID and biology. And they basically opened him up to the literature about marine life, and particularly whales and dolphins and porpoises. So he's really self-taught, which is hard. I mean, that is a little bit of a learning curve versus someone who might go down a marine biology route with a teacher, gives them a lot of the information. But that goes to show how passionate he was. And he, he's just basically, people that he's worked with have been awesome, and they've helped him with his quote unquote career development. And for now, he's just spreading the love, and really he's out on a boat, and he's doing what he's passionate about and getting other people excited about whales, dolphins, and porpoises, and doing great for their conservation. Cause I know they do like a lot of IDing and, you know, learning, like you said, learning about what individuals are where is very important for tracking them. So hats off to you, Elf and Poof, or Pew.
Poor dude. I hope he's a listener and he's like,
those darn Americans. But yeah, no, just, I was just a real,
that's awesome.
Yeah. I just think that it's just never too late to do your part, and you can do a lot like he did. Obviously really, really involved. Or you could probably, or you can do a little. At the zoo where I used to work at, there was what we called docents or volunteers, and a lot of them were 60 or older, and they could, and then there are sometimes kids too, like to help out. And yeah, and they're not paid, but they come to the zoo once or twice a week and handle animals and help educate. And they have to go through rigorous training, of course, to get certified. And obviously that's just one option, especially if you're, a natural born educator. But yeah, so don't ever think that you can't get involved with, of course, there's tons of education you can do through social media and telling your friends about all these cool animals and cool podcasts and conservation sites. But in the same instance, there's definitely stuff that you can do. It's never too late. In fact,
that might
be me out on a boat someday with Elfin. Cause
I know I keep wanting, I follow, again, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, the website, www.allcreaturespod.com. If you can give a little plug for us, but I do follow whale watching out of Auckland and they saw a blue whale and her calf the other day. I was like, I got to go on this boat.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
Got to go on this boat. Yeah. So I will try to get up and do some whale watching because I'm dying to see blue whales. You know, or get whenever Dr. Getz goes out there, I need to go with her. Absolutely. So I know I sniped this one from you, Angie, but I had to talk about this one. This is insanity. Insanity.
I'm like smiling from ear to ear right now.
I know. I am just amazed. This is so science fiction. So the title is Worms Frozen in Permafrost for Up to 42,000 Years Come Back to Life. Like, what in the
heck? You were not paying attention to the podcast, yelling at your kids or texting or something, let's back up. 42,000. Not 42, not 4,200. Three zeros, 42,000 years.
Yes. Yeah, these are roundworms. They were in the frozen in the permafrost. So in a petri dish, they took them out in Siberia. They took them to the lab. In a petri dish, they came back to life and started eating.
Yeah.
And moving around. They were alive. It's alive. Like, That is crazy. Because I, again, going back to this whole
cloning, I knew you'd
thing,
go there. I'm like, Chris loves things. Yeah, I was, no, I go, I know.
But I did, because I was like, okay, we have these mammoth carcasses. Like, I know they have a whole carcass except the head. Like, the whole body was frozen. And I was like, okay, there you go. There's your cells to clone the mammoth. Just grow those in a petri dish, blah, 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 blah. Well, DNA right. degrades over time. So that's kind of where I looked some stuff up. First of all, these are the oldest living animals.
First
on the
of all,
planet,
it's so
period.
Funny. Yeah. Well, and it goes into the difference between you and me. And I was like, dang, I would love a 42,000 long nap, year long nap. Could you imagine, like, waking up from that?
Yeah.
I'd be like,
God.
What?
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I didn't, I kind of stopped thinking about it from there. I, of course, I thought a little bit about the DNA and how this and what advances can be made as far as chiroprotection and chiroconservation and even astrobiology and some really cool things like that. But yeah, I figured I'd save my brain energy and let you go down the route of cloning.
Yeah. So even, these mammoth carcasses that are frozen, the DNA breaks down. So that's why these cells, they can't regenerate them. So what the scientists have done is they've mapped the genome of the mammoth. Now they know the genetic code from A to Z.
Sure.
And then they're going in
blanks.
Yeah. And then they're editing. So it is like what they talk about in Jurassic Park. Oh, we used, dino DNA and frog DNA and combined it. And here we have these dinosaurs. Kind of what they've done, or that's why the mammoth clone is just going to be a hybrid of an elephant. They're
right.
just going to manipulate the DNA to what the mammoth is.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, how in the heck did the DNA on these things? But anyway, so I went down the DNA path real quick. Half-life of DNA is about 500 years.
Okay.
So what that means is it starts to break down, the backbone of that holds DNA molecules together. So looking at this scientific article, it said under ideal conditions, DNA would last about 6.8 million years. And that means at the end of that, every single bond would be broken.
Okay.
Okay. But what's cool is we can still read DNA after, like, if it's 1.5 million years old, we can still read it. But after that, it really, you can't read what it was, what base pair it was, all that stuff. The oldest DNA we've ever read is about 800,000 years.
Okay.
Old. Okay. So how in the heck did these nematodes and these roundworms survive?
We can read it, but it's not functioning. But yet in these nematodes, it obviously is fine.
Yeah, they said, this is the first multicellular organism for long-term cryobiosis.
Right. Yeah. They've done one, and I don't know if it was nematode, and it was 39 years. So we went from 39 years to 42,000. Holy shnikes.
So they just said that these things have some adaptive mechanisms and it's going to have some effects on cryomedicine, cryobiology, astrobiology. I mean, things like, if we ever did travel to Alpha Centauri, how long would it take? How many hundreds of years? I'm talking way before you and I are long, way past. This is going to sleep and coming back in 40,000 years and we'll have the technology to do this.
Yeah.
But, if human exploration of space and you go into cryosleep, we in sci-fi movies. So we can study this nematode, see what mechanisms it has and start applying it to medicine, things like that. So that was crazy.
Yeah. It's
crazy sci-fi.
Amazing. It's just, I think the thing is, like, with nematodes in general, they definitely have their ability to withstand certain extreme environmental condition is, are just basically kind of programmed in their DNA, certain ones. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what exactly is that? What does it mean? I think is to be determined. Yeah. But it's definitely super interesting for cryoconservation. Or it made me think, like, geez, what is up in that ice on Mars, right? Type deal.
Yeah, maybe we don't want to unearth. Was it Transformers? I don't remember one of those movies.
Well, Chris, along those lines, but. Much like, let's get back to Earth and to something that we can, something
that's some sci-fi novel.
I read that, and I'm like, that's crazy, whatever. We need to talk about it, but so I'm glad you talked about it. But this is a little bit more Angie speed. So, as far as wildlife news is kind of cool, or medical news is, Recently, researchers reported out of Guelph, the University of Guelph, which is Canada. So another shout out to our lovely mm-hmm. Canadians, have reported Canada, that leopard geckos, which is a type of it's obviously a type of gecko, duh, but they're really cute. I used to work with them at the zoo, but they're actually kind of popular in the pet trade and they're not endangered. I'm sure certain types of species are in general, there's a lot of them. But a new research has shown that leopard geckos can make new brain cells. So I don't think they can withstand 42,000 years of cryopreservation.
Right.
Although that hasn't been proven yet, so who knows. But what the researchers out of Guelph have discovered, that these leopard geckos have a type of stem cell that allow them to create new brain cells and provides evidence that the lizards have the ability to regenerate parts of their brain after injury.
Okay.
So they're constantly renewing these brain cells. And this is something that humans are really notoriously bad at doing, right?
Especially slow, like 40-50 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then our brains degrade. Yeah.
And that's why head injuries can be obviously very traumatic and
horrific.
And not a lot of times not able to bounce back from them. So it's really interesting that it's exciting because basically this provides evidence of new neuron formation in this and stem cells in the leopard gecko's brain. And there has been similar studies in zebrafish, so in a fish, and salamanders. This work is using lizards, which is the next step up the evolutionary tree closer to humans. So it'll just be interesting to see how this can translate into human medicine and what we can learn from this cute little gecko that, and this is just one species of gecko. I mean, who knows what you and I always, it's a common theme on the podcast is like when people don't want to save animals or conserve animals or let certain species go extinct, I'm like, but we don't know enough about them. And even if you don't care about them or their behavior or their ecology or whatever, what if they can help us humans? And so I think most people listen to this podcast or most people in general, obviously have been touched by somebody that's suffered some type of head injury or
catastrophic injury.
Neurological disease, Alzheimer's, something. So, the mysteries for probably a lot of these regenerative issues lie somewhere in our ancestors, and we kind of deserve it to them and to ourselves to try to save them.
Yeah, and it's, just kind of how we decipher some of this is we will learn what cellular mechanisms are driving that, like in the cryobiology with these nematodes or with this leopard gecko. Scientists will figure out, okay, mechanically, how does this work in cell biology? Then we can start looking at applying those treatments to higher order of species. So that's why we talked about rats, and mice.
Exactly.
We gave a nod to mice a couple weeks ago. And then if it works in mice, that's really exciting. Then we move on to higher order of mammals and then finally do human trials. So, we're years and years away from something like that, but these initial discoveries
are huge.
These species are huge. Huge impact.
And that's the thing.
Like I said, the regenerative medicine, they think a 200-year-old person, some biologist believes, already been born, is walking on Earth. They just don't know it yet because we're going to have regenerative medicine at some point where we can slow down or reverse aging.
Yeah, and I could have used some kind of something regenerative when I was sick with the flu the other week. Oh my goodness gracious. But exactly, Chris. And that's the thing is like, we're at the infancy of knowing obviously what the adaptations that you and I, talk about every week of this is so cool. This speech, this naked mole rat this lizard does this
sea dragon does that. Yeah. The dads.
So exactly. Sea dragons, seahorses get pregnant. Sea dragons, it's not quite a true pregnancy. Yeah. But so we have a lot to learn. Animals have a lot to teach us. And maybe you don't believe that they grieve, that certain ones don't grieve, but from some of their physiological adaptations and standpoint, you have to give, hats off to them. And if, brilliant scientists can figure out some of the ways they do some of these adaptations, it would only benefit potentially benefit humans and our loved ones and our kids, yeah. kids, and things like that.
And then just finally, Angie, species of the week. I know this has kind of gone long, so I'll just make it quick, but this really awesome looking frog. I know in Central and South America, we're finding these all the time. This one's really beautiful. Again, I'll put the pictures on the show notes. Its top side is green. Underside is like a poison dart frog, but orange with like some, it's like tiger striping.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Tiger stripes.
Yeah. It's gorgeous, really cool.
Gorgeous amber yellow eyes.
Yeah. So, you know, amphibian conservationist Andrew Gray from the Manchester Museum, he named it the Sylvia's tree frog. And he named it after his granddaughter, which is really cute.
I love it.
So, it was collected in Panama in 1925. But they confused it with the splendid tree frog. But now that they've gone back and looked at it and said, no, this is its own species. And so now it's been officially described. And so there you go. So we have a new frog. They're so beautiful.
Awesome.
God, those poison dart frogs are just amazing. They're amazing.
Yeah, okay. Super, super charming. Yeah. We'll put a link on the show notes so you can enjoy this cute little guy as well.
Yeah, he's cool. All right. Well, I will see you in a few days. We got a new animal coming next week.
Yes, it's going to be a really exciting week. I know I'm looking forward to it. And it's definitely a species right up my alley. That'll be your hint.
Yes. There you go. All right. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Thanks, Chris. Bye.